nice to be here. I love your walls.
Hello and welcome to the Scannon Podcast. The dulcet tones of Niall are back for a limited appearance. We'll call it a one and done special. Now, I came back from Cannes and the lad said, you might as well come and talk to us. Yes, so I said, yes, happy days. So I'm joined today by Darren, who's in
the, hello.
He's in a guest
It's
chair.
So weird. It's yeah. so weird.
It's great. Am I the Ian Hislop or the other guy?
We'll go with Ian Hislop. I didn't give more Ian Hislop.
And that's
oh, shit, I'm Paul Merton. God damn it.
And that's Jason Coyle swearing early
oh, yeah, sorry.
In the podcast,
sorry.
Getting us off to a fine start. So guys, we'll start with, as we always do, with what you've been watching recently. And to keep it tight, please, I like to run a tight ship. None of this 2 hour long podcast.
Hold on, don't look at me. This is what happens when you step away. I mean, you know. All right, fine. Let's do this very, very quickly then. All right, so what have I watched since last we talked? I've watched a bunch of stuff in the top 10 and the new releases that we can't really talk about. So let's hammer this and go with, I watched Glitter. Which I'll be talking about at some point in the near future. I won't talk about that. Thunder Road, which is releasing next week, so we'll be talking about that in more depth there. But it's I quite liked it. It's very American indie, right down to opening with a song and dance number. But no, it's got a lot of great sort of, it's got a lot of emotion in it. It's a comedy that's not really a comedy.
So
in
it's
the
a
style,
it's,
and this, I suppose you're being very cynical. You describe in those terms.
Accurate, I think,
well,
is the.
In fairness, I mean, it takes its title from a song. That having a song and dance number in it.
Yeah.
Based on that song.
Makes
that,
sense. Yeah.
And that's what's in the short.
And
they do exhaust me a little bit.
And Cummings is great. Writer, director, and actor. It's a very emotional, very sweet, very sincere film. I mean, and I say that as somebody who has a notorious heart of stone, that it was very, very emotional and affected me really deeply. So I was really glad to watch it.
And genuinely and, lovely guy. He travels with the film. He travelled with short as well. He came to Kerry to the Kerry International Film Festival.
Yeah.
And he's now in the UK doing a tour with Thunder Road.
Oh yeah, well Thunder, the distribution on this is amazing. Like this is the little indie that can. This is like can, as you're well aware. But no, this is the indie film that raised money through Kickstarter that doesn't really have that much of a distribution outside of touring and outside of sort of word of mouth. And it's done a remarkable job. And it's actually one of those great sort of life affirming sort of stories that a little mid-budget, low-budget film.
All right, I feel kind of bad kicking the crap out of it.
Yeah.
I didn't know all of that. God
damn
it.
Yeah.
Still probably won't see it. But having said that, I still appreciate it.
Just assume that all indie movies have a very difficult time getting to screen, says
yes.
he that works for an indie movie production company.
Yes.
But more on that later.
Yeah.
But yeah, so I also rewatched the first two John Wick films, which were good fun, very insightful. And again, I'm a really big fan of them. What's interesting, going back and watching them, is their sense of humor, of all things, that really struck me, is that it's got they've got this wonderful sense of humor that's very arch and very dry and very wry and like is not self-aware or sort of self-mocking in the way that we associate with the modern tone of blockbuster defined by, say, Whedon in The Avengers, where there's a sense of, I think Luke Dunn, who's been a guest on the podcast, has described it as, ha, we made the joke so you don't have to, or ha, we made the joke so you can't make the joke. There's a lot more sort of traditional sort of like wry, the situation is hilarious but the characters play it straight, which therefore like heightens the sort of sense of abstraction there. I'm thinking in particular of like scenes where, you know, Viggo has it explained to him, I heard you took it upon yourself to slap my boy. Yeah? You want to tell me why? They stole John Wick's car and they killed his dog. Dramatic beat. Oh. That sort of level of self-awareness, or like I once saw him kill three men with a pencil, and the film sort of like builds on that in a way that's very clever and very shrewd, and which plays very well to the persona. We were talking a little bit about this off mic, and the question of like, is the John Wick series like so popular because people like Keanu Reeves, and could you build it around another franchise action star? And what's interesting is that I think that you could to a certain extent, but it would require reconfiguring the films. And that the Wick films are very arch, very dry, very buttoned down, very sort of like straight-laced in a way that we associate with Keanu Reeves, where there's sort of this kind of veneer rather than this overly emotional exterior. Like, I think if you were making them with Jason Statham, they'd be a lot quippier, they'd be a lot faster, they'd be a lot more playful in inverted commas. In sort
they'd
of a,
be part of the Fast and Furious
they would
universe.
Be, yeah. That
or
sort
Crank,
of
or
Crank,
the greatest films ever.
Or Man on Fire, which only got one, but it would have been a great trilogy.
I love those movies as well, absolutely, but I think that
Man's still on fire.
man, we think he's almost out, but we're not quite sure yet, so let's make another one. But yeah, no, I really like both of them. I do think the second one still drags a little bit with the introduction to mythology, but it has these incredible set pieces, like the silent jewel, the wonderful bit, the reflections of the self, the battling in Momo, and this sort of testament to stunt as, you know, to stunt work as an art form of itself, the point where they're literally putting it in museums and art galleries, which I think is very, again, the kind of thing that would be pretentious and unbearable if the movies weren't, you get a sense, aware of how absurdly over the top and sort of exaggerated this is. So yeah, really, really like them. And then finally, a movie I've been looking forward to for quite some time arrived on Netflix, because, you know, I'm a big fan of international cinema. I mean, yourself and Ronan typically represent the podcast, but, you know, I like to think that I broaden my horizons, willing to try new things, embrace different cultures and different ideas. So I watched the biggest Chinese movie of all time, The Wandering Earth, which is something, let me tell you. In case you're not aware, The Wandering Earth was the biggest movie of all time at the Chinese box office when it was released. I'm not sure if it still is, but I assume Avengers Endgame hasn't toppled it yet. It is a science fiction blockbuster based on the Hugo-winning novel. It has nothing to do with the Hugo-winning novel. It is very much in the style of a Michael Bay action movie. The basic plot of the film consists of the sun is rapidly expanding, going to consume the Earth. So what do? We strap a bunch of rockets to the Earth and decide to ride it off into space, like it's something from Doctor Strangelove. However, it gets better.
Wow.
All of a sudden, except so we're hurtling.
Science does not support that at all.
Oh, Niall.
Steady, Niall. That is not where you need to go with this.
You have heard nothing yet, let me tell you.
The neutrinos are mutating.
Right. Halfway through the solar system, one of the Earth engines, and by the way, they keep saying Earth engines in a way that reminds me of Earth Angel. Love that. But anyway, one of the Earth engines breaks down, which causes the Earth's course to rapidly alter, sending it on a collision course with Jupiter. Our intrepid crew of heroes have to get to that Earth engine, fire it back up, and get Earth literally back on course before it collides with Jupiter. There's a sequence in this where a man with a minigun rages at the heavens, fires at Jupiter as it looms large on the horizon while screaming, "Screw you, Jupiter!" And I kept thinking, this should be more fun than it is. It is very much a Chinese version of an American blockbuster, specifically Armageddon, but very much that Michael Bay school. And it reflects a trend in Chinese blockbusters and Chinese big budget movies in general recently that you've seen with stuff like Wolf Warrior 2, for example. But even things like Escape Plan 2, which was for international release, but was very much funded by Chinese
Escape
money.
Escape Plan 3 is coming. It got dated today.
Of course it did. China Salesman as well, which is this sort of like appropriation of like American 80s style propaganda film. For a new audience or for a new generation, using them for a different sort of context. Like, and it's weird watching all those tropes factored through like Chinese self-image. So, for example, this has that very, you remember in the 90s, the Clinton era, when America was like the unchallenged global superpower? And so there was a real sort of like welcoming international vibe to their patriotic blockbusters. Like, remember in Independence Day, when the rest of the world sat back and cheered as America led them to victory on our Independence Day? Think of like the plot to blow up the UN in The Peacemaker. Or even like the international flavor of the team in Mission Impossible. There's a sense of that here, where the United Earth government has put aside all of their differences so that they can be saved by China from like the challenges and hurdles of being like consumed by Jupiter. Yeah. There's even like the plucky comic relief foreigner character, which again, you kind of expect looking at American blockbusters. Here it's a Chinese Australian named Tim, whose hair is bleached blonde, who provides all sorts of manner of cheap and unfunny hijinks that puncture the sort of sense of humor. It's fascinating to watch in that context, but it's not good. It is deathly dull. Again, for a movie that features a man firing a minigun at Jupiter yelling, "Screw you, Jupiter." I'm not exaggerating. That's not like subtext. That is the text. It's surprisingly somber. It moves far too quickly. Its scale is too large. There's no stakes, ironically enough, despite the fact the entire planet is running the risk of colliding with Jupiter. It's very inert. It feels like a collection of set pieces and cliches mashed together, and it doesn't really work. And it's really disappointing because...
it's Roland Emmerich's Melancholia.
Kind of.
Wow, there's an alternative universe.
And the CGI is surprisingly not great at points. Like, there's all the exterior scenes, which obviously have to be shot on green screen, look like there's something like one of those low rent like Pixar knockoff studios that you see, where you have them like riding trucks down icy roads. Oh, there's also a wonderful moment just in case you thought that the propaganda would be purely subtle and sort of symbolic, where they're driving through Shanghai. They take a look at the frozen remains of the 2024 Olympic Stadium and say, look at these tall buildings. A lot of people used to live here. Back then, no one was concerned about the sun. Everyone was concerned about a thing called money. Just in case you were worried that they hadn't vanquished capitalism. But yeah, so it's
wonderful. I thought I'd probably pass that to be honest.
Yeah, I don't think I was the best salesman there. Or the best China blockbuster salesman, it were.
Yeah.
No word on a China salesman sequel, unfortunately.
Darren, you'll end up bankrolling yourself. Such is the way you do these things.
But yeah, so that was my week in film. Oh, and I also watched Dark Knight Rises, but I suspect we'll talk about that next week. Jay.
You can't even stop posting for a second. Look, passing it on. I like it, Darren. Professionalism at its best. Yeah, I watched a few. I continued my Columbia Noir season on Criterion Channel with Fritz Lang's Human Desire from 1954, which is really fascinating. It stars Glenn Ford and Gloria Graham. Gloria Graham, who I've kind of fascinated more so now after watching Film Stars Down in Liverpool, which is fascinating in and of itself, where Annette Bening plays her.
With Jamie Bell, is
Jamie Bell, yeah, that's the one, yeah. So it's kind of weird after watching that, coming kind of back to a film that she's in. And this is really interesting. It's a kind of film about a guy who's fired from a job at the railroad. And it has this look, actually looks kind of like Unstoppable, the Scott film. It has that kind of odd tone that I love Unstoppable so much. But as this guy's fired from the railroad, he asks his wife, who, and he's this guy, like, he's just married some woman that's so out of his league that you wonder how they ever got together, you know. And she knew the guy at everyone's railroad. She asks, he asks her to try to get his job back. She spends an afternoon with him, the boss, then he gets really jealous, saying, you know, what were you doing to get my job back, kind of thing. And then into this comes Glenn Ford, who's the hapless war hero back from Korea, who's back working on the railroads, and he gets kind of flim-flammed into this on the train, as the way these things go. And this has this...
He gets railroaded.
Well set up there. Well done, everyone. So there's just a super first error.
Thanks for keeping us on track now.
Yes, Jesus. It's quite a nasty and vicious little story of kind of murder and deceit, and particularly so, like, the first hour is kind of it's all set up and then release of the original kind of plan of it, and works really, really well, and kind of vicious more so than you'd expect for a mid-50s film. The problem kind of is with the film is that the second half drags a little bit. It kind of, you're feeling for about 20-25 minutes, it's Treadmore doesn't really know what to do with this. Once it's got past the initial kind of bit, it's like, okay, where do we do this, before it rallies towards the end and kind of, it's like somebody's resolved, it's like, oh yeah, this is what we do, and it works really well. Glenn Ford is fine, he does his thing. Gloria Graham is fantastic in that kind of femme fatale, playing everybody
sort of
kind of role,
and
that's
very
noir.
Much what she's very good at.
And she's great. And an actor who I'm not really very familiar with, Broderick Crawford, who plays the husband, is terrifying in that kind of old school big guy, physical, aggressive kind of thing, and he's really, really good. It's really interesting. It's not the best of the noirs I've seen, but it's nevertheless fascinating, even if it's a bit messy overall. But certainly worth a watch. I followed up with a film that I've only seen the remake of, and watched the original finally, which is Wages of Fear.
Ooh, La Salle de Peau.
Yeah, indeed. I've seen Sorcerer, which is the William Friedkin.
I apologize to Grace and Phil and any other listeners who actually know how to speak French.
Luckily, I don't, so it's great. I don't know what you're doing. The Sorcerer, which William Friedkin made in the 70s, which is the remake of Wages of Fear.
Which is astounding.
Sorcerer's great. I saw it at the IFI Open Day a few years ago, and it's astonishing on the big screen. So I've been wanting to watch this for a while, so I sat down to watch it the weekend.
Would you go so far as to say it was dynamite?
I might.
A bridge too far.
Indeed. Obviously, it's in black and white. It's a 1953. And the black and white in that kind of sweaty jungle kind of...
atmosphere.
...town.
Yeah.
And it does similar things to Sorcerer as well. It spends about an hour kind of knocking around this town with these characters, getting to know them before the pivotal plot kicks in. Sources with flashbacks as well, but which just doesn't really dispense with that idea. And the characterization work really pays off, and then the kind of grueling set pieces ahead when they start to drive trucks across
bridges
and down and streets and all sorts of and through jungles and kind of desert ground and stuff to get to the fire, to kind of put out the fire in the oil fields. It's a very cynical film, as you'd expect. If you'd seen Sorcerer, you'd certainly have an idea of that. This kind of stuff about American foreign policy and who owns the oil fields and all this kind of stuff in it, which I really like. And the tension is, at points, unbearable.
Yeah.
And this final scene, which I'm not going to spoil, so to speak, in Scientific 3, but if you want to watch it, it's the editing. It's worth looking out. The editing is staggering. Some of the best edited kind of final 3 or 4 minutes of the film I've seen in I don't know how long. Amazing. It cuts between two scenes, and the camera work and editing is astonishing. I think I marginally prefer Sorcerer. Controversially, apparently. I think it's a better, slightly better film. For various reasons.
No, I don't mean really like that. I just mean I thought Sorcerer was generally... it seems to have been rediscovered and loved.
Oh yeah, Sorcerer's great. And most people love it, but most people would suggest that this is better. I would slightly disagree, but I could see why they think that. Yeah, exactly.
They're both very good.
They absolutely are. But I loved it. I also watched Persepolis.
It's like the Cape Fears. They're both very good.
Yeah. I'd actually agree with that. Yeah, I like Scorsese ones. Very
I think the Scorsese one's underrated. Like a lot of his sort of more schlocky stuff. Yeah. A lot of his like unimportant and inverted comedy stuff.
Yeah. No, Cape Fear is quite fun. Very love letter to fun 50s cinema that way. Like, except with, you know, kind of slightly more graphic scenes.
Well, yes, the subtext is rendered a bit more overt.
Yeah, to say the least. God help Juliette Lewis. But yeah, I watched Persepolis.
I love that.
Which is first time watch. I'd never seen it.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
But Darren, we can't all watch all the films. There's trillions of films
to watch. There's no judgment here. It's just I was kind of like
your love of things like Mary and Max. Yeah. I'm surprised.
Listen, these things happen. That's all I can say.
It's not The Wandering Earth. If I've seen it, I sort of assumed it was like.
It's not The Wandering Earth, you're right. It
definitely isn't The Wandering Earth, I can tell you that, listeners.
No, indeed. This is the film version of Marjan Satrapi, I think. She wrote the graphic novel that's based on and co-directed this. It's a remarkable film. It's kind of a story about the kind of history of Iran, I guess, through a young girl's eyes as she grows older and kind of appreciates more the effects that these things like war and misogyny and religious oppression and trauma, emigration, depression, all these things have on both a country and the person. And how that's viewed both from inside the country and outside the country. And now once you leave and come back, you're never quite part of the original place you were. Like, you're kind of neither from there or here after a certain point. And the animation is gorgeous, as you'd expect, but it's really, like, the scenes, particularly in Vienna, with that kind of foggy kind of thing, the black and white really lends itself to it, and it's gorgeous. Like, I mean, shimmering beauty in it. Like, it
gives a Third Man
esque. Yeah, exactly. That's exactly what I thought of. The story is bleak, but very beautiful and very moving at points, and very funny. Like, I mean, the film is really funny. She's a great kind of voiceover and stuff and talking about everything, and she's hysterical, and does one of the great Eye of the Tiger song versions of something I've ever seen. I was in stitches listening to it. I absolutely loved it. It's one of those ones I could see myself happily watching over and over. It's really great. And, you know, welcome to 2007, Jay. It's only 12 years later, but we got there in the end. And finally, rewatches. I watched.
When I heard about it, I ran out to see it.
Oh
darn. Jesus.
Oh, fine.
You, honestly, sometimes. You're fired, darn. Get out. I rewatched The Wild Bunch. My favourite Western of all time. I dig it out every so often just to kind of remind myself that it actually exists in
just
a lot of ways.
Look at the cover.
Yeah.
Yes, but indeed, yes. Yeah. But it's in that kind of 2 or 3 year period of kind of the Bonnie and Clyde, just before the 70s New Hollywood stuff, where the studios are being dismantled in the way that they are. This is one of the films that put the nails in the coffin in that regard. And it's also...
With any hope that's coming again.
Yes, indeed, yeah. But we can only hope in that cinema. But The Wild Bunch is one of the most amoral, violent, brutal films ever made. It's an astonishing opening with the insects, if you ever remember it, the little kids around the thing, which kind of says all you need to know about the film in about 2 minutes.
Yeah, you're either in or out at that point.
And the kind of touch of modernity, I still get shocked by the time when a car rolls into it, which is stunning. Because it's a Western, right? And you don't really get told when it is, except these guys are aging and they're running out of road in both literal and kind of metaphorical sense. Like, their way is gone, and a car drives into the compound, and it's staggering as a scene. Like, it's absolutely staggering. It stuns me anew every time, and I've seen it like 5 or 6 times. It's savage, bruised, bleak. It's just relentless. It's nihilistic. It's unreal. The violence in it, the last kind of half hour or 25 minutes of when you get hold of the big kind of Gatling gun that they've robbed off the train, the staggering amount of bodies that kind of go away. But it's and all in the purpose of that ironic sense of doing the right thing finally, as a kind of but as suicide mission essentially. It is astonishing, absolutely astonishing. And the cast are great. Holden playing an absolute bastard as a kind of cap of a career that he's played great, great parts, but he is astonishing. There's Ernest Borgnine. There's loads of great kind of faces that you'll have seen in lots of films over the years that just pop up. And it's like, I can't think of a Western that comes anywhere near it. That's one of the great best films ever made, but certainly my favourite Western. Astonishing. That's me.
Great. Well, so on the flight over to Cannes, I decided to rewatch Gone Girl. I don't know why. I'm a huge Fincher fan. It is. No. I don't know why I picked it. I just did. I'm a huge Fincher fan, as I've declared many, many times. And it's the slow burn is just brilliant in it. It's just, and it sets itself up so well. Like it's much like what Nolan tends to do, in that he's playing three dimensional chess with an audience, and Fincher does the same stuff in this. You can't, even if you've read the source material and even if you've watched it before, you're still looking for the links that and the clues throughout as to what is happening with Amy and her amazing Amy and the search for her and what she has done. It's brilliant because I mean they set up the central conceit that she loves doing these sort of treasure hunts, and then the whole film is a treasure hunt.
What I remember about it is, again, I've watched it a couple of times, and it's great. Watching it with an audience the first time who had no idea what was coming, and there's two moments in particular. The first one is the very obvious one that comes around the halfway point, where the film sort of reveals a little bit of what it's doing, which is great because it kind of hands over the narrative to its one of its central characters in a way it hadn't before, which is just breathtaking. And the other bit involves Neil Patrick Harris towards the climax, which is quite literally and figuratively towards the climax, but which is, just staggering. Because, again, it feels like the movie's... You feel like you've got a read on what the movie is and what it's doing, and it just goes to 11, sort of through the ceiling again, which is remarkable.
Because he's taken essentially what is a pulpy novel and just elevating it in a way that Steve McQueen was trying to do at Widows and...
Failed.
didn't quite do to the same extent, but it's that thing where the story, or at least the written narrative, is not as strong as the visual narrative in this particular instance, but it means it's one of those things where,
and it's a cast help enormously.
Jaws is the same.
Those are not great books to be entirely clear, having read them, if we're being diplomatic.
I've only seen it once, and I liked it when I saw it, and I've been on the rewatch list for quite a while, particularly with some distance from it as well. I did like it, perhaps not as much as everyone else at the time, which is standard, but I'm looking forward to rewatching it.
Oh yeah, there was a time there where Rosamund Pike was kind of just cast as a love interest in everything. And
she's fantastic.
This is absolutely central.
And Carrie Coon. God bless her.
Carrie Coon as the relentless, dogged, Fargo-esque police.
That's Kim Dickens, isn't it? I thought Carrie Coon was the sister.
Kim Dickens.
Carrie Coon. Carrie Coon
is great. Kim Dickens
is fantastic. Yeah. Anyway,
just in general.
Yeah. Yes.
I mean, even the and I think it actually kind of leveled out to a nice place where it's not as ubiquitous as Fight Club, so it doesn't have the same baggage. Despite the fact that if it were a bigger film, culturally speaking, it would probably be a bit more uncomfortable to talk about. In the same way, the Fight Club is now, where it comes with all this loaded imagery.
Fight Club is inherently misogynistic, though. And Fight Club really suffers from the kind of people who embrace
really like Fight Club.
Yeah, but then so then on the way back, because this is good, I watched Fast and Furious 8.
AKA the one where The Rock kicks a torpedo.
Yeah, because this was 10 o'clock at night, a late flight, and I did not want to be thinking at all. And it is so much fun. Submarine chase. There's a car chase involving a submarine. I mean, that's all you need.
And I mean, like, it's the movie where The Rock and Vin Diesel, because I believe Vin Diesel may or may not have been a candy ass, but where they weren't talking to one another.
Yeah, and Vin Diesel is a producer, so he managed to like cut scenes out with The Rock in them.
But I mean, like, so the big emotional confrontation between the two, because they couldn't be on set together, involves the two of them in monster trucks at opposite end of the street, speaking through car stereo systems, because you can't have the two actors in the same space at the same time. It's amazing.
It is essentially the scene from Heat, but with monster trucks. Yeah.
But imagine instead of being in a cafe, they're on a street, and instead of being in suits, they're in monster trucks.
This
it's exactly like that.
Terrible.
Oh, it is. Well, but brilliant.
Boy.
It's not as good as 5. It's probably not quite as good as 6, but it's better than 7.
It's better than 7.
Yeah. It's better than Tokyo Drift, I'd say, is it?
Oh, yeah, and 4. Drift. And 2. And probably 1.
Yeah, but 1 is so far away from everything else. 1 is about street racing. This, they're James Bond. Like, so
Superheroes with cars.
I don't want to know
anymore. You promised, Jay. I promised.
And I'm never going to watch the rest of them.
But they're so entertaining.
They're terrible.
They're great. Well, okay. The last 4 are average out to be great.
Yeah. It says,
I mean, Hobbs and Shaw, come on.
The 3.5 minute trailer? No.
They do have some good banter in Last Days, or
well, I mean that's what sold the idea of Statham and The Rock as their own sort of team. They have their little Deadpool 2 in prison moment as well, if I recall.
They do, yeah.
Oh no.
Yeah. So then, because I was in the Cannes mood, I watched Claire's Camera from Hong Sang Soo from last year's Cannes.
I didn't see that. I've watched a couple of his films on MovieHead, kind of retrospective of his career. I caught a couple of them, but I missed that, unfortunately.
It is exactly like all of the rest of his films. It deals with similar things. But what it does have is it has a superb Isabelle Huppert auditioning for Greta, essentially. She's unhinged, but not to the same extent that she's unhinged in Greta. And it's just, allowing Isabelle Huppert just go mental. It should be a national pastime, you know.
Well, I do like that she's reached the stage of her career where she has a persona with the kind of audiences who you never thought would watch a Huppert film, which is striking. Because generally,
means you can do pretty much anything.
That's it exactly. Like, because you kind of like to get to that stage, you normally have to like sell your soul and do like blockbusters or
particularly for a French actress, and a kind of classical kind of trained French actress.
And it's like watch Greta, the trashy, and I love Greta, the really trashy 90s thriller where Huppert riffs upon her Scream persona.
Yeah.
Even if the kind of audience who's looking for a trashy 90s thriller probably has, never seen
it. No idea who Isabelle Huppert is, but that doesn't matter.
And it works. I really, really like
it. This is kind of the gateway drug to that. So this is semi-serious. It's an introspective film about, studying melodrama and that kind of the thing the French cinema loves very much with a South Korean director.
I've watched a couple of films. I'm not completely sold on them. And I think I had a conversation with Ronan where he's watched either one or two of them and he's not completely sold either. I can understand the attraction of his films, but they seem to be the same film.
They essentially are.
Riffs on the same kind of ideas,
which
is fine. And there's some great stuff in them, but I'm not sure they're great films, if you know what I mean. They're fascinating, but I'm not sure they're my cup of tea, I think, maybe.
No, that's it. I mean, they are for different audiences.
Absolutely.
The Cannes last year went bloody nuts for this. Cannes this year doesn't seem doesn't seem to have gone as nuts for anything except The Lighthouse. They really
The Lighthouse and Parasite to some degree.
Parasite as well.
Robert Pattinson, the greatest on-screen masturbator of our generation.
It's true.
And with that, I'll stick with what was happening in Cannes. So Vivarium,
I'm really excited about.
Larkin Finnegan's.
It's got great
feature-length Black Mirror episode. So Darren, you will really
I'm on board with this. I was on board when you said Lorcan Finnegan. I was on board when they cast the two leads, and now I'm on board when you mentioned Black Mirror.
Jesse Eisenberg and Imogen Poots, and it's a superb term from Imogen Poots. As people, I won't go too far into what the general plot of it is, but they go to look for a house in an estate, and it turns out that the estate agent disappears, and then they can't escape from the estate, and other things happen,
which is very familiar. Like, again, you can see an extrapolation from the themes that interest Finnegan as a director.
Well, and Gareth Shandling, his writer. They're a creative duo.
Because Foxes as well was a similar. It was literally a ghost estate movie to a certain extent.
Yeah.
And even Without Name is very much about the relationship we have with land and development.
And Gareth Shandling wrote a short that was animated that deals with a something similar to what happens in to an event-based film. So they are tying together the narrative ideas that they enjoy,
or that the suburban that shared universe
that they're working out on screen, which is but yeah, it won an award, but the distribution prize at for Critics Week. So this is the first time since 1963, and that was a short, but this is the first feature that played in Critics Week at Cannes, Irish feature that played in Critics Week at Cannes. So it went down remarkably well.
The reviews have been pretty strong.
Viva Bavaria, mate.
Yeah, no, it was great. So also at Luxembourg, they are also at Cannes, in the Luxembourg Pavilion, they launched a new scheme, a new co-development scheme between Film Fund Luxembourg and Screen Ireland. And so this is for female-led films that have a female director or female writer, and it's to develop them. So so the POV was production-based, this is development-based, and so it's to see co-development, but both sides are putting up the same amount of money. So essentially,
very good.
Up to 120,000 for three projects. So so it was great. And that exact same thing, because I happened to be there, because I was part of the Irish delegation, they had... James Hickey who's now stepping down as Screen Ireland head. He got given a medal of friendship, essentially, from the Grand Duchy of Luxembourg, and it was a very nice ceremony. You know that. So I mentioned there in that story that the POV was the female led sort of version of the Catalyst program. They announced the four projects. It was only originally going to be three, and now it's the four projects that are going into production as part of the POV scheme. So Lisa Mulcahy, who previously directed Legend of Longwood, is going to direct a film called Noel. It's based on Sherilyn Le Fanu's thriller, gothic thriller. So that's going to be very interesting. It's written by Elizabeth Gooch, and it's being produced by Ruth Carter, who was one of the producers on Demo and Ivor for Blooming Films. Then Antonio Campbell Hughes, who did the short last year, Quest for Love, or Q4L, has written and directed a kind of neo-noir type film set in London, and that's going to be produced by Connor Barry of Savage, who did Pilgrimage.
Very good.
Then Elva Keown, who wrote Take Me Swimming, has written a film called Sunlight, which Claire Dix, who also did Take Me Swimming, and is a fine documentary.
Broken Song, her documentary from a few years ago, was very good, and also taught me a screenwriting course a few years ago. She's very good.
Yeah, so Sunlight is their film, and that's Roisin Gearrtaí of Blinder Films, so that Katie Holly's house there is going to produce that. That's a compassionate comedy, is how they're describing that, about a recovering addict. And then You're Not My Mother, Kate Dolan, who did brilliant job with a kind of a noir thriller short called Cat Calls last year or year before. She is going to do one. Yeah, You're Not My Mother, and Deirdre Levins, who was a producer for Fantastic Films, who were the guys who made Vivarium, is going to is producing that. So they're the four, and they're very exciting to see that female talent is being backed to the extent that Screen Ireland is
properly going, that's is proper like down. Features
yeah.
Like,
yeah, you know, they're all the Catalyst gave 350, these are all getting 400, and so Catalyst produced Without Name, which we were talking about, Larkin's first feature, and then it also produced the one from last year, the Set on the Border, that I can't remember the name of, visual one that.
Oh yes, Aoife McArdle's one.
Aoife McArdle's film, yes.
Which is has a woman's name in the title.
Kissing Candice.
Kissing Candice. Yes.
So that was the other Catalyst film. So they that's what they were doing. So they proved that you can make high quality, fine looking films for a low budget.
Kissing Candice looks amazing. Looks great.
So today, Principal Photography has begun on a new Irish language feature from Michaela Churl, who over in Galway. So it's part of the Cine Cahir scheme between TG Cahir and Screen Ireland and the BAI.
Very good.
This is Mugra Boon, which is the guys who made Traitors have written and directed it. And it's set in the Gaeltacht region in Ring in County Waterford. and involves a mysterious dog who may or may not be the deceased husband of a woman.
I'm in.
It seems like it belongs in the like dog's purpose, dog's journey, shared universe. Dennis Quaid is back, baby.
Oscar.
Yeah.
But
there's a lot you don't know about this
Larkin
dog.
Larkin Cranage, who's in The Dig,
yes,
is in, yeah, the book, along with Brittany Ogden and Cillian O'Garvey, who was in Blood Vikings. And so,
but up for the Oscars.
I'm really excited for it. Larkin was talking to me when we were down at The Dig in Dungarvan recently about going to go make it, and he was very excited by this, and he was telling me the story, and it sounds mad.
Excellent.
Then, last but not least, there's a new distribution company on the scene. So we have a fourth distribution company.
Breakout Pictures,
which is Nell Roddy, formerly of Element Pictures, and Robert Finn, formerly of Element Pictures, who have joined together to create this new distribution company, and they're going to start with Metal Heart, which is out on the 28th of June. Now, in the interest of fairness, I work for Treasure, so they're produced Metal Heart, so
I'm really looking forward to Metal Heart, actually.
But you were big on it anyway.
I was
well before this last call last year.
Yeah, it's Hugh O'Connor. It's his directorial debut. Hugh is the nicest man
in
Irish film. He is unreal. So yeah, Jordan Jones is great in it. Liam McNamara is great in it, and Maud Dunford is in it.
Ubiquitous.
He's really good in it, but he plays.
What is he had like
an
eight film year last year or something like that? Six.
Yeah.
I very much look forward to it. I missed out Galway, unfortunately, so I'm really forward to seeing it.
Yeah, and so there are other films that they're going to be doing later in the summer. Is 1 Million American Dreams, which also played at Galway last year. It's very good. It's a documentary from Brendan Byrne. About there's an island in New York where essentially the unclaimed go and are buried.
Yeah.
And it is staggering that, you know, that's kind of relationship stories and things that they are drawn out of that, and there's animation in it that's just incredible. And then they're going to do Ian Fitzgibbon's Dark Lies of the Island, which is based on the Kevin Barry novels, which played at the the Dublin Film Festival recently.
I tell you something, as a baptism of fire, I'm really fascinated as to how they're going to market this. Because we both myself and Darren have seen this.
Which one?
Dark Lies.
No, I missed that one.
Did you miss it?
No, I was there.
Oh,
yeah,
it was
there,
yeah. I'm fascinated.
We are interchangeable, apparently.
We are. I'm fascinated as to how they're going to market this, because...
What did I see instead?
It defies description tonally in a lot of ways,
it'll
be a tricky one.
Yeah.
So, like, I kind of enjoyed it. I couldn't stop thinking about it, even if I wasn't sure it was very good or not.
I'm exactly the same. I'm not. I'm convinced that there's fine performances.
There's fine stuff in it. Yeah.
And the further I get away from it, the more I like it. But it stayed with me.
I'm saying, and I was looking at going, I don't know if this is terrible or good, but I can't stop thinking about it.
And this autumn, then, they're going to release Tom Burke's feature doc, Losing Alaska, which is amazing.
Okay.
So this is a documentary set within a community in Alaska that is slowly but surely sinking into the sea.
Wow.
Oh, this sounds good.
Yeah.
Okay.
And so it shows the very real consequences of climate change, you know, so surely we must put it in front of Mr. Trump when he comes over.
Indeed.
It's just going to be difficult. He won't leave his golf club.
There is that.
Well, you could sink that.
Get some milkshakes.
Never mind, sorry.
In Doombeg. If you're going to go down. So we'll move on to the top 10.
Do it.
I haven't seen this one either, so I haven't seen the top 10 for this week, so this is novel. I'm very excited about this. This is all going to be hot and fresh.
I sent you
for
the
highlight
10 the other day.
Oh, I don't...
You didn't actually. You don't read anything you send them in the dial.
That's
have you not listened to the podcast?
We disparage you at every turn, Niall. Don't listen.
I do listen. Because I edit it after that.
We joke, and I'm joking, of course. Kind of joke.
Yeah, just... Because that's how you are. You're just lovely, lovely guys.
It's true.
I missed you terribly.
We did actually miss you.
Before we go into stuff, then, I will say that Avengers is doing gangbuster still, and is now the sixth highest grossing film of all time in Ireland.
It's
pretty impressive.
It's not the highest grossing film of the week.
Yep.
So.
And the Irish top 10 of all time is interesting in its inclusion of the Simpsons movie of all things. But we do love our comedy here.
We certainly do. Comedy and animation.
Yeah, and both of them together.
We need to make an animated comedy and make billions, Darren.
Yeah, this is the plan. There's your Countess Markovitch biopic waiting to happen.
No.
How is
we're
that
going to
a
comedy?
Right. How could you possibly do Countess Markovitch as a
black comedy, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, they're keeping that pure, Darren. That's going to be great.
If we ever get it made.
Yes, yeah, we will.
My Markovic gets that go. No.
Oh, no. Right. Quick, get to the top 10. Quickly. Stop him.
At 10, breakthrough. Huh? 20th Century Fox's Breakthrough.
Oh, yes. The one starring Topher Grace, Dennis Haysbert, the Christian movie that we talked about. Where
that got the top 10?
But just barely.
How much?
It made 10,000.
10 grand got you in the top 10?
I imagine this top 10 is very top heavy. Based on past experience.
Yeah. 10 grand. You should have released a good film this week, yeah. People, whoever you are.
I think, like, High Life didn't make the top 10.
So, wow.
So, yeah. I'm going to. Oh, well, wait. Okay, maybe it did.
No, it didn't. So. Of course not.
10 grand.
Yeah.
Evangelical faith based films, you know, like, so there is a certain audience right there. They're the same audience.
Yeah, they're nearly dead now, so.
Who vote for Peter Casey?
Well, you remember that, yeah, that was that big story about the two Irish filmmakers who made the anti abortion film in the States last year.
They really wanted me to write about that, and I was not doing it.
Yeah, I know.
But yeah, that made the top 10 over in the States as well, which gives you an idea of how big the audience is for that sort of entertainment.
Well, Faith-based shooting Roma Downey, who is an Irish...
Yeah, is a company, like she's a woman production company. Yeah,
exactly,
kind of
she's
stuff.
Huge. She managed to then make Ben-Hur based on the money that they were able to get through the other parts of their empire.
Good Lord.
At 9, Wonder Park. So keeping
and it climbed! It was up from 10 last week.
Yeah, so that we
people will literally go see any animated film.
Is it any wonder...
Yeah, it's you need to distract the children. You know?
Yeah, just keep the director away from them. Yeah.
In terms of box office, it's knocking it out of the park.
Yeah, well, this looked like it would be enjoyable. I was going to bring my son to it, but we never got around to it. Anyway, at 8, Dumbo,
which is better than it should be, and you know.
Tim Burton, better than it should be.
Yeah, well, I mean, like, hold on, we're going to be talking.
He cleared the lowest of bars.
We're going to be talking about this later in the podcast, no, but anyway, let's just seed this now. If you're adapting like an old-fashioned Disney animated film for live action, in inverted commas, as much as CGI, that level of CGI can be called live action, at least Dumbo understands, again, as a part of a relic of being like a 1940s film, that it has to fill the space with something, and so decides to do this kind of really odd, off-ball, gentle, but Disney owns everything, so why can't Disney own criticism of Disney? Yeah. And it's you know, it's something worth doing. I don't think it does it particularly well or particularly gracefully, but it's at least more interesting than, hey, remember this thing that worked in live action? Worked in animation. We're going to try and transfer it into live action, inverted commas, and hope that it works for you. I'm going to put a pin in that because I feel like we'll be coming back to that later.
Yes, we will. Long Shot at 7.
This is the Seth Rogen one, right?
For the Charlize Theron, where they make an inexplicable couple.
Do they make an inexplicable couple?
That's the thing. That's the storyline. The storyline is that they make an inexplicable couple.
Everybody's an inexplicable couple with Charlize Theron, though, in fairness.
I was going to say, this is like the AOC thing, where it's like she has a scruffy boyfriend. Oh, how crazy is that?
Yeah.
Having been the
scruffy boyfriend. There's nothing wrong with being a scruffy boyfriend.
I aspire to be a scruffy boyfriend.
One day, Darren, my ship will come in.
My scruffy ship will come in, apparently. Yes.
Moving on, at 6, A Dog's Journey.
Yeah, so that's still there. Apparently there's a big market for dog-related movies.
Yeah, there's an article in The Guardian saying of the top 15 dog movies. Films ranked.
Does this rank?
Well, All Dogs Go to Heaven.
I don't know if it is in there, actually. Although I only took out my favourites because... Umberto D and Wendy and Lucy are in there, which I
How'd John Wick do?
Anna Bilson wrote it, which is obviously good.
Bilson's great. Bilson's very, very good at that.
John Wick's in there.
Of course it is great.
All Dogs Go to Heaven, that's all you need. And then you're set.
100 Dalmatians.
The others in there as well.
No, and obviously Lady and the Tramp.
Yeah, well, you know. Go and read it and surprise yourselves.
All right.
Speaking of dogs, F5 and one I've seen, Paw Patrol Mighty Pups.
Course you have.
Tell me all about it,
Niall. Hold on here. Niall's
I'm sitting
the floor,
back.
Yeah?
Oh, here we go.
Okay. This is...
Did it give you pause? Were you barking mad after you saw it?
It was a bit rough though.
This has led to a very interesting review by Tara Brady, essentially, where she
went viral a little bit, didn't
it? Full on existentialism stuff. Oh, it was mental. Anyway, Paw Patrol Mighty Pups is a 22 20-minute episodes bolted together to make a 45-minute film, to which they add on two additional episodes of some of completely different TV shows in order to pad out the running time. Right,
this is a scam.
Now that they've duped the parents out of the money, the content of said movie is very, by the numbers, action, the superhero film. So the Paw Patrol, essentially the central premise of Paw Patrol is this guy called Ryder, this kid called Ryder, has six pups who work for him in solving problems around the town of Adventure Bay. So it's like Postman, or like Fireman Sam, but with
dogs.
With dogs, and yeah, and it, there's no other sort of police
social
force
service,
or anything
yeah.
like that. The mayor has a very odd, creepy relationship with this boy who has these dogs, and he has
it sounds very much like those Super Friends where there'd always be a problem every week that Aquaman could solve.
Yeah,
it's so, like, what is our dog related problem
so
this week?
Each of the dogs has a different thing. So one of them's a fireman, so that's Marshall. One of them sees a fire marshal, see, get it, oh it's clever. Yeah. Then there's a police, Chase. Oh, Chase is the police dog. Oh yeah.
Oh
yeah.
Stop.
You're kind of courting.
I can't take any more shtick, please stop.
Then there's Rocky, the recycling pup, and then Rubble, who is the builder, and then Sky, who can fly, shockingly, and Zuma is the one, the water pup. So essentially, they all have their own areas of expertise. They all get superpowered, and because a meteor crashes to Earth, but also the villain guy gets superpowered as well and creates a superpowered robot, and they get separated from their master and they have to solve the problem themselves.
Is the villain a cat?
No, but the villain has cats.
Oh.
Yeah, so he has the kitten catastrophe crew who are
still on board.
Yeah. So there's 45. Yeah, but the thing is that it's two episodes bolted together.
Yeah.
It is not a film. It's not a feature length in any way, shape, or form. It's fine, but it works for TV. And yeah, if your kids like Paw Patrol, they'll like the movie. But don't go expecting anything very good. Whereas I brought him home and immediately turned on Teen Titans Go.
Teen Titans Go is great.
Yes,
it's
yes.
really great.
Because
yeah, really
I insisted that you actually watch something good.
Teen Titans Go, the movie, is one of the better superhero movies of last year.
I must watch it, actually. It's been on my watch list for a while.
Anyway, at four, The Hustle.
Oh, this is the Dirty Rotten Scoundrels, but with Rebel Wilson and Anne Hathaway.
Yeah.
Two laugh film I've been heard
of.
That's I've heard
widely regarded as being dreadful.
It's a pity.
It seems the real hustle was on the audience all along.
Oh, at three, Avengers Endgame.
Still doing very well for itself.
Yeah, now up to €6 million at the Irish box office.
Yeah, I'm sure that's pennies in the ocean.
How much is it worldwide, actually? Do we know?
Oh, is it 2.5 billion?
Will it overhaul Avatar?
It won't. No, it'll fall just short.
It'll come very close. It'll come closer than I think a lot of people were anticipating,
even
those who were like, it will be the second biggest movie of all time. So good for it.
Yeah, but we were all Avengers Endgame out in terms of talk.
Yeah, I know. I'm happy to not talk about it.
Yeah.
At two, John Wick, Chapter 3, Parabellum.
What? Oh, this is interesting.
Yes, it
this
didn't.
This is very interesting.
John Wick did not dethrone the champion. Yeah.
Wicca, wicca.
That's probably because I didn't go see it.
At number one is John Wickachu.
There's a crossover with him. I will say, I saw on Twitter the suggestion that, like, for the next film, for if they're doing John Wick 4 and haven't seen John Wick 3, they're doing John Wick 4.
They are. It got dated.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But they should do a crossover with Barry in the style of, like, sort of one of those 80s TV shows where, like, Magnum PI would go visit Murder, She Wrote.
Yeah.
And then Jessica Fletcher would pop over to my, you know. So, you know.
I think he would have been great in the Avengers universe. He wouldn't need anybody.
I was going to say Thanos when he just sort of...
Yeah,
disappeared John Wick's dog.
that's pretty good.
Yeah, so John Wick is at three, is at two, and Pokemon Detective Pikachu is at one.
That's made a bit of money,
which is great. I'm actually quite happy with Detective Pikachu. It's not amazing, but it does what it does really well. And having like looking at things like Sonic the Hedgehog, and even like looking at a film that we're going to be talking about in a little while here, and its use of CGI animals, the use of CGI in Detective Pikachu and the animation in Detective Pikachu, where they cleverly don't go for whatever photorealism would be with Pokemon. And again, just look at Sonic. Look at Sonic.
Oh, I was just going to say that there is an entire subgenre of adult entertainment dedicated
Niall, I didn't need to know that. Gotta blank them all. But yeah, thank you
for
that mental image.
Too late for that.
Pika, baby.
Stop, it's too much. It's too much.
Just want to take another Pikachu. Detective Pikachu, though, does it remarkably well. And I kind of admire the fact, Luke mentioned this last week, so we can talk about it now. I kind of love the fact that it's a PG-rated Get Out. The movie is essentially Get Out, but for kids. I kind of like that.
Yeah, I still haven't seen it. I may or may not.
On to the new watches.
What have we got?
What have you seen, Darren? You
of the two, so Aladdin.
Yeah, we'll start alphabetically with Aladdin.
But yes. Don't do that, because I don't know what comes next.
Guide you in the ways.
Yeah, Aladdin is okay. Like, I mean, you're never going to get past the hurdle with a film like this. And the hurdle with a film like this
Guy Ritchie's Aladdin.
Let's make that clear. Okay. Because,
But you're never going to get past the central hurdle with a film like this. And the same problem that Beauty and the Beast had, which is that you are adapting something that worked almost perfectly, or as close to perfectly as possible.
But they don't
in
care.
It's
going to make
money. No, it's going to make...
That's all it is.
It's going to make somewhere in the region of $1 billion.
But that's all it all is. Like, the quality is incidental. Of it is incidental. It's about doing the same thing for more money.
An interesting observation I had in conversation with somebody online about this was the remark that shooting this on digital, in particular, and the way that digital allows for the manipulation of the image and allows for this almost like cartoonish live action quality, like kind of hints at what maybe Disney are trying to do here, which is to line up these intellectual properties for the purposes of things like their theme parks. So the idea, and again, we talk about this with Dumbo, where like Dumbo is a film from 1940 with a bunch of racist crows in it. So you want something that you can show to kids now. Parents might be a bit tetchy about that, so just reinvent it as a live action vertical comics film with CGI that you can put in front of them.
Plus, you can make it better
Aladdin
for an audience.
Was from 1992, they can shove it in front of people.
And Disney's attitude has been ever since the failure of the Princess and the Frog that kids don't want conventional 2D animation in theaters. I know that things like Teen Titans Go would suggest otherwise, but
I'm not sure Disney even believed that. I think what Disney have done, and indeed what
they're monetizing their existing IP.
And they'll make all the actual films, even though they're very close to digital versions of the thing anyway, but then they'll re-release all their animations again, and it's just a circular thing that they just keep making money off, because that's all they do, and buy everything and own everything and swallow up the world.
But with that in mind, and accepting that huge caveat and the problems it creates, most notably the fact that, again, the CGI animals, where you're going for verisimilitude, and this is something that really freaks me out about the Lion King trailer. I haven't seen it. I will see the inverted commas live action Lion King and see how it works there. I have seen the trailer.
Oh, okay.
The trailer is really strange, because you're looking at these things that are designed to look like real lions but talking like people, and it's like you're removing that aspect of expression and like personality from the cartoon creations, which doesn't like is really uncomfortable and weird. But even Aladdin has that with like the tiger, with Iago the parrot, and with the monkey as well, where these things are CGI recreations of them. They don't necessarily look real, but they also don't look like they should be talking or behaving in an anthropomorphized fashion, which is kind of creepy. But more generally speaking, you have things like the fact that if you're doing it live action, you can't do the ridiculously literalized One Step song or One Step Ahead, where you have him dancing in front of sheep while singing he's ahead of the flock. So he's using metaphors while he's singing that have no bearing to what you're watching on screen. What I will say in the film's defense, two things. First of all, it understands that a large part of what made the animated Aladdin work was star persona, the casting of Robin Williams. Now, Robin Williams, of course, often comfortable with the use of his star persona to market it. But generally speaking, Robin Williams' arrival heralded an era in animation where celebrities were cast and where they became a huge hook, but where you started seeing like personas bleeding through. Think of things like Eddie Murphy, for example, in Mulan. Take one example, Danny DeVito in Hercules, that sort of stuff. Even James Earl Jones, to a lesser extent, you could argue, in The Lion King.
Yeah, well, Danny DeVito is actually animated as
Danny DeVito. But I mean, and so Ritchie understands that you need a star for the role of the genie, and once the film hits the bit where Will Smith shows up, he has a nice enough presence. Like, Smith is one of the rare movie stars, in inverted commas, who still exists, even if he hasn't adapted to the modern landscape in the way that, say, Tom Cruise has. Smith hasn't figured out how to be a movie star in the 21st century. He's tried things like comic book movies, and they haven't worked for him.
The soppy drama, sentimental drama.
And they haven't worked for him either. But here, he's allowed to just be a movie star, and to have presence, and to count on his screen persona, and to not disguise the fact that he's Will Smith. Like, I mean, that monstrous blue thing that appears in the trailer and haunts your nightmares is only on screen for about like 5 minutes of the movie in total. The rest of the time it's Will Smith being Will Smith and gonna be Will Smith, and it's, you know, and the film understands that's a large part of the appeal. What I will also say is that it's 40 minutes longer than the animated film, because of course it is, but it has a much better understanding of how to use those 40 minutes than Beauty and the Beast did. Beauty and the Beast added 40 minutes but had no idea what to do, so you got stuff like Belle's backstory with her mother, and you're like,
to Paris and involving the plague.
Yeah.
Why are you involving the plague in this film?
What is necessary? What does this add to the story you're telling? Aladdin doesn't necessarily, like, they don't add anything to the story, but they realize where there are gaps that they can fill. So things like Jafar gets a much clearer character arc and development, and he gets contrasted with Aladdin as, you know, sort of this aspect of him being another social striver who's pretending to be a prince. But Jasmine notably gets an Alan Menken song, an I Want song, I think is the Howard Ashman, the songs that he created for Bell, to pick an example. Yeah. Now, obviously, it's written by Menken, it's not written by Ashman, because Ashman passed away, unfortunately, during the original Aladdin, yeah. The original animated one. So the lyrics aren't as good, and you can tell every time you hit a song that isn't an Ashman song that it's not an Ashman song, very obviously, but it understands that maybe that's something you should add to a film. I mean, it's fine. It's going to make $1 billion anyway.
How long is it?
It's 2 hours and 10 minutes.
It's not horrendous.
Two hours and 10 minutes, because you're bringing kids to it is long.
Yeah,
right,
yeah. Yeah. I mean, like, watch the animated version instead.
Beauty and the Beast much longer?
No, Beauty and the Beast was 2 hours. It was probably shorter.
Oh, jeez, it felt longer.
It did feel longer, didn't it? Because, again, when you have an 80-minute movie that's perfect at 80 minutes and you add 40... Like, I'm the guy on the podcast who's like, a movie's as long as it needs to be. And it's like, when you have a movie that's 80 minutes long... Adding half of that again, unless you know exactly what you're adding, isn't good.
Yeah.
But anyway, so yeah, Aladdin.
Okay, other movie that's already out, Rocket Man.
Came out
midweek.
Please don't sing there.
Okay. Yeah, well, I mean, to be fair, I was going to say I'd be as good as Taron Egerton, but I'm not. Egerton's actually pretty good. I didn't hate this. It's not good. I didn't
love
it.
That's not selling it, Darren. What about all those 5-star reviews I keep hearing about?
Really? I've been seeing a lot of 4 stars. I've been seeing a lot of people who like this a lot.
But I've been a bit funny, okay, though, because some of the 5-star reviews on the Rocketman Twitter account go, this 5-star film you really need to see.
This is the thing. Rocketman is very much the movie that Bohemian Rhapsody wanted to be, and in that sense sort of showcases the limit of Bohemian Rhapsody's ambitions. But the issue with Rocketman is it works very well when it's a musical. It's actually much more of a conventional musical than Bohemian Rhapsody was, in that you have these sequences that are done in the style of old-fashioned musicals, like I Want Love.
There's a Bollywood sequence in it.
In Aladdin.
No, is there not Bollywood Bollywood-inspired sequence
Sorry, I didn't even get to the Bollywood sequence in Aladdin, but don't worry, it'll be sticking around the top 10. We'll get to that later. But I mean, the thing with Rocketman is that it has actual musical sequences. So you have like this old-fashioned like 40s and 50 version. So I think, is it Hot Cat? Okay.
You say so?
But basically this sort of rise to fame sort of story that's told entirely through song. You have I Want Love performed by the residents of a small sort of 60s British household where they're all singing about how repressed they are, trading verses and choruses. And like when it's a musical, it works very well. Even like the title song Rocket Man, which is performed as a metaphor for like alienation of like hospitalization and addiction and relapse and things like that. And even like I'm Still Standing, which is performed recreating the music video, which again probably played very well to Cannes, which was like when it premiered like 100 meters from where the video was shot. If you want to talk about why the Cannes audience was so ecstatic about Rocket Man, it's like, yeah, Cannes, baby.
It's that they absolutely loved when The Rock turned up as a crocodile.
But
a croc.
A dial rock. But no, like in those musical sequences, it works rather well. And the reason that it works rather well in those musical sequences is the same reason that it doesn't work when it's not a musical. This is a movie that has no sense of subtext. It has no sense of nuance, which is great in musical numbers where you're having characters literally state their expressions through song and dance. And you can be as imaginative, you can be as broad.
Yeah.
Like there's a moment where he's playing Crocodile Rock and he literally elevates the audience and himself in a literal sense. They're floating off the ground. The only issue is when you try and apply that to drama, you end up with nonsense like, for example, Reginald Dwight, 8-year-old kid, turning to his grandmother and saying, "I wish I was someone else." Reginald Dwight, 23-year-old like musician, piano player, asking somebody else how to become a rock star celebrity, says, "You have to kill the person you were supposed to be the person that you want to be." Things like that. You have like the father.
Sorry, did this not happen in Avengers? Thor had to become the person that he...
You have the father who's like just discovered his wife cheating on him, and who's resented the family for tying him down, literally shouting as he walks out the door, "You tied me down with that kid 12 years ago. I finally have a reason to leave," as the door slams, in case the audience doesn't get the subtext of the scene that's playing out. And it continues until the climax of the film, where Elton has his entire arc explained to him by an apparition of his best friend. "Elton, you make records that make millions of people happy. You just need to figure out who you are and learn to love yourself." Thus completing his character arc in the bluntest manner possible. This is like the extension of like that stuff that the Nolan brothers popularized with the theme as dialogue stuff. You either live long enough to die a hero or you become the villain or whatever, that sort of stuff. The thing of state, Darren mangles it.
Wait, he misquoted
Nolan. Yeah, I know. But
make sure that stays in the podcast. Now,
you either die a hero, or you live long enough to see yourself become.
Too late now.
I know. But like that sort of thing, like, fear is a powerful tool. All this sort of stuff that like is like here's the theme of your movie in dialogue form, and you know Nolan's very good at that. Certain directors are very good at that. Rocket Man is not very
Dexter
good at
Fletcher.
That.
We should say.
Yeah, and to be fair, Fletcher does a good job directing. I imagine the problems are mostly screenplay based.
Yeah.
No,
and you can go see it guilt free this time, though, as opposed to Brian Singer smelling up the last one.
Yeah. And watching it, you can see what parts of Bo Rap were Fletcher's. In particular, like that shot of cameras panning around pianos with heavily CGI backdrops to create the illusion of long takes. Very much a Fletcher.
I'm not seeing this, I don't think. This sounds brutal.
It's not like, I mean, I like Elton John's music.
I can take or leave it, and I don't mind the biopic done quite well. This is
Work Hard
in the post Work Hard era.
Yeah,
but they're coming back though.
They are.
Bohemian Rhapsody made $1 billion.
No, even before that, like, I mean, films are sneaking back.
Yes, that as well.
But that
one,
there
sorry, one two. Yeah. Best editing. Oh, for the love of
but like
course.
Oh, and we now live in the Paul Reed cinematic universe as well, which astounds me.
Yeah, but different Paul Reed.
Yeah, you can choose. You can have your Paul Reed of choice, your predatory gay manager. You can have either Aidan Gillen or Richard Madden. You've got your Game of Thrones actors. Which one do you choose? I kind of would love to see like Aidan Gillen in Rocket Man in the same role.
I'd like to see another film made and somebody else from Game of Thrones playing.
just sort of rotate through. Kit Harington.
No.
Think outside the
box. You can sign David Bowie. I don't want it.
Maisie Williams. Maisie Williams can do anything.
That's true. And she rips off his face.
It's like we're going to sign the band to another album label. She's my queen. Sorry.
Are my queen. I would do anything for you. Last big film release of the week is The Secret Life of Pets 2. So I will be seeing this very soon.
I haven't seen The Secret Life of Pets.
It's enjoyable. It's
should I see it?
Patton Oswalt, right?
You have no reason to see it.
As far as dog-related, like CGI animated films go, Niall, how does this rank compared to like
the cats
Paws?
Are more interesting in Secret Life of Pets than the dogs. Dogs are fine, but the Secret Life of Pets is interesting because I mean it is what the pets do
Okay, Toy Story.
When the people aren't there, yeah, exactly. But it's not as good as Toy Story.
I would imagine not.
But it sells the merchandise. We have one of the cats from the Secret Life of Pets at home. So I will see the second one, but I don't. Yeah, I can't speak to its quality.
But in the grand scheme of way these things are diminishing returns,
I mean, like it's going to knock Wonder Park out of the top 10,
which we can all be grateful.
I mean, that is a pet peeve of yours.
The best thing I can say about Secret Life Pets is having seen it about 20 times, it doesn't grate on you.
That's a decent enough recommendation in that regard. That's fair enough. So it's not great, but it doesn't grate.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. I think I'll retire on that line. That's as good as I'll ever
do. I don't think we need to take it further.
Woo!
That's going on his tombstone.
Finally.
All right, we'll leave it there.
A champion in the category.
Brilliant.